In Buddhism, the practitioner is offered sustenance from what is called the triple treasure, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Sustenance comes from the Buddha because his awakening represents the potential for awakening in each being, each of our Buddha nature. The Dharma, which represents the eternal truth and the teachings that can bring liberation, is the second source of sustenance. The third and equal treasure, the Sangha, is the community of awakened beings and all who practice the Dharma. Sangha means spiritual community, and it is treasured because without it, awakening cannot be sustained. The Sangha carries the teachings and acknowledges that we cannot awaken alone. The world of spiritual prayer and practice is sustained through teachers, spiritual friends, and community. As we practice, we become part of the process of nourishing the awakening of others. Every moment of compassion or understanding that we awaken spills from us to our families, our community, our world. The community of the sacred is revered in Judaism as the minyan, the minimum number of Jews needed for a prayer service. It is the sacred communion of the Sufis, the satsang of Hinduism, and the holy Christian love whenever two or more are gathered in his name. However it may be expressed, true community is central to spiritual life. From isolation to community. One old Hasidic rabbi asked his pupils how they could tell when the night had ended and the day had begun, for that is the time for certain holy prayers. "Is it," proposed one student, "when you can see an animal in the distance and tell whether it is a sheep or a dog?" "No," answered the rabbi. "Is it when you can clearly see the lines on your own palm? Is it when you can look at a tree in the distance and tell if it is a fig or a pear tree?" "No," answered the rabbi each time. "Then what is it?" the pupil demanded. "It is when you can look on the face of any man or woman and see that they are your sister or brother. Until then, it is still night." In the maturing of spiritual life, we move from the wisdom of transcendence, that spiritual illumination beyond the world, to the wisdom of immanence. We discover that the sacred is always here. The natural cycles of spiritual life that carry us away to mystic solitude eventually return us to some form of community. Just in this way, the one who has sought and tamed the sacred ox in the Zen accounts must inevitably return with their gifts to the world. This return can be difficult, especially because so much of the spirit of true community has been lost in our times, even lost to ourselves. Contemporary life is marked by atomization, where each individual is hurrying, spinning in his or her own direction. One can literally see the individualistic forces in modern society, each person in a car, houses with separate rooms for each person, offices where each works at a computer terminal, children raised in front of a television. Modern American individualism too often entails what Marion Wright Edelman calls the sacrifice of our community and our children. How can we return to such a marketplace with, as the ox-herding story suggests, gift-bestowing hands? It is not easy. Westerners who complete long periods of Buddhist or Hindu retreats generally experience confusion and isolation when they return. Retreatants and yogis often speak of the difficulties and conflicts they find as they re-enter the sorrows and complexity of modern life. A key to bridging these worlds is spiritual friendship. A compassionate friendship is one of the most important gifts we can offer to one another. To sustain spiritual life, we need one another's eyes and hearts as surely as we need help creating food and shelter. This reflection and encouragement is no small thing. As Adrian Rich says, truthfulness, honor, is not something that springs ablaze of itself. It has to be created between people. Sangha and spiritual friendship appear in surprising forms. Over the years, I have participated in a series of retreats for young men from the inner cities. Most of these youth are former gang members who are finding their way back from an environment of despair, racism, poverty, and violence. Invariably, what begins their return is a friend, a mentor, a benefactor. Even for a moment, there had to be someone who saw their beauty, their possibility. It may have been a grandmother, a custodian at school, a teacher, or an uncle in the neighborhood. The experience of being truly seen and honored by another reminds us of who we are. We cannot underestimate the importance of the awakening we bring to one another. It is not only the street youth who need companionship on the path. Several monastics who run retreat centers spoke of how hungry their guests are for spiritual friendship and how this makes the monks and nuns even more grateful for their own community. Community is a blessing. A Western Lama described this aspect of practice. In the 3-year retreat, we were thrown together in our tiny retreat compound, 15 of us, as if we were married and dropped into a war zone. It was that intense. Living closely with others for years on end rounds off your rough edges. You can't fool yourself because others see you more clearly than you allow yourself to see. It was also a very bonding time. In a way, living collectively was as valuable as all the other meditations. It brought alive the teaching of compassion moment to moment. Now my main practice has become communion, to recognize the living spirit in everyone, in everything, not just in peaceful people. If you look in anybody's eyes, the light is shining there, also in every animal, every leaf, every flower and dewdrop, in every clod of earth. People are no more enlightened in the monastery than out in the world. It's the same everywhere. Spirituality is not about the mountaintops. It is seeing the sacred right here, celebrating and affirming perfection just now. Even our enemies show us how to awaken if we recognize the truth. Community is also difficult. Community, however important to a full human life, is not easy. Living with others evokes all kinds of difficulties. When we get close enough to one another to offer love and support in an intimate way, our old family patterns, our fears, our needs, our limitations show up as well. They're all right there in front of our nose. We may be able to avoid conflict in our prayer and meditation, but in community, we might as well not try. Conflict will come. A few ancient accounts of spiritual community speak of harmony, living together like milk and water, regarding each other with kindly eyes. But more frequently, the ancient texts are filled with accounts of problems. Hasidic tales recount many conflicts among community members and between teachers and students. The early Christian stories tell of conflicts and struggles in the community, and the epistles of Paul are filled with advice on resolving these difficulties. The first 7 volumes of the Buddhist scriptures, devoted entirely to the topic of spiritual community, spell out hundreds of tales of the conflict, misdeeds, and difficulties that arose among the monks and nuns even while the Buddha was still alive. There was the Buddha's jealous cousin who tried to have the Buddha murdered, and then later a quarrel among the obstinate monks at Kosambi got so bad that they would not even listen to the Buddha. Finally, he threw up his hands and left to live among the peaceable animals of the forest, leaving the monks for a time to work things out on their own. One Hindu teacher describes her reluctance to engage in community. After years in India, I returned and became a well-known leader of yoga retreats. I would fly from one city to another. People kept saying, "Let's start a big year-round yoga community," but I avoided that. Even when my friends got a large ashram, I kept going away to travel and teach. Finally, it dawned on me I simply didn't want community, especially with me in the teacher role. It was too much responsibility, too hard to be close to all these people. I suppose it evoked the unhappiness of my family. I couldn't imagine being together without it being stifling and painful. I just wasn't ready. If we expect community relationships to be ideal, spiritual, friendly, enlightened, we are seeking what we can't even expect of our own mind. To want the company of others without suffering is unrealistic. But if we avoid close relationships, we will also suffer. In a wise spiritual community, we acknowledge our difficulties and choose to help one another anyway. Sometimes we will be the one to carry the blessing of spaciousness and love. Sometimes it's we who will carry conflict and trouble to the group. This, too, is a gift others can learn from. We play both roles in this plot, switching periodically. If we go to spiritual community in search of perfect peace, we will inevitably meet failure. But if we understand spiritual community as a place to mature our practice of steadiness, patience, and compassion, to become conscious together with others, then we have the fertile soil of awakening. One Korean Zen master told students that their communal practice was like putting potatoes in a pot and spinning them around together long enough to rub off all the peels. In community, we become mirrors for one another. An older nun remembers, "In my second community, there were only a dozen nuns. I liked all but two. One was lazy, the other was self-absorbed. After my first year, I was in the kitchen complaining to a friend who said, 'You know, these are really not bad people. What is it that gets to you?' And I said, 'One is lazy, and the other takes too much care of herself.' And she replied, 'Well, you ought to be more lazy and take better care of yourself.'" Our spiritual formation, what was called our training, came collectively. We weren't given much time for private prayer, and all our individual life as young women was almost entirely surrendered to a communal whole. This was a trial in many ways and required a great trust because it sacrificed so many desires. It was not like solitary Christian and Buddhist training where you wrestle with yourself alone. For us, community came first, and years later, we would find the individual emerging from that communal world of prayer and dedication. To really let go into that training, the surrender to the difficulty as a gift, brought an ecstasy. It was a gift to be with other souls moving toward a great goal. I still love it when I meet sisters who have gone through this collective awakening. You learn to join together on the level of the heart. To live a complete spiritual life, we need to learn how to be with one another. Such accounts do not mean that we have to leave our job, our home, or family to find a monastic community. We have the opportunity to learn about community all the time. There are others all around us who can highlight our prejudices, our fear, our attachments, and show us the way to an open heart. One man, a military officer who was studying meditation in a class for stress reduction, recently found this out at the supermarket. It was a crowded evening, the lines long, and the woman carrying a child in front of him had just one item but would not get into the express line. The officer, whose habit was impatience, began to get annoyed with her. It got worse when she got to the checkout stand and she and the clerk started cooing over the baby. The woman even handed the child to the clerk. He began to tense up, his anger building at the thought of how selfish she was. But because he had just come from his class, he noticed what he was doing to himself and began to breathe more softly and relax. He even noticed that it was a cute baby. By the time he got to the clerk, he had let go enough to say, "That was a cute boy." "Oh, thank you. That was my baby," she replied. "You see, my husband was in the Air Force, but he died last year in a plane crash. Now my mother takes care of my boy and brings him in once a day so I can see him." We judge each other so quickly, yet know so little about what another carries in his or her heart. To truly awaken to grace and sacred presence, we must offer to all the same respect we would give a great teacher. The sloppy, angry, inconvenient, hurried, difficult Buddhas around us can teach us steadiness, equanimity, and compassion. We are the grist for one another's mill. A close friend, the psychiatrist and consciousness researcher Stan Grof, tells a story of one such teaching that took place soon after he arrived in the United States. Through his work at Johns Hopkins Medical School, Stan met with a psychiatrist of Native American origin, who had arranged a visit for Stan and several other staff members to his traditional peyote circle in Kansas. When they arrived, they were driven far out onto the plains to meet the road chief, the elder who runs the ceremonies for the Native American church. Although the chief had previously agreed to include the visitors, the other Indians who saw these white men balked, and it took a good deal of persuasion to allow this unusual participation. The history of anti-Indian prejudice, the monumental losses of Indian culture, the genocide at the hand of white people were still painful. But because the Johns Hopkins doctors had come a long distance, they were finally permitted to join the circle. Still, one man clung stubbornly to his anger at the white men who had come to steal this last Indian treasure, their spiritual gold. All through the night-long ceremony, his mood only amplified by the peyote and drumming, this angry man sat silently, glaring at Stan, who sat opposite him in the peyote circle. By morning, he had not softened, even after a whole night of prayers. It seemed as if this was how it would end, in an angry standoff. Finally, on the last round of blessings, the host psychiatrist thanked the tribe for being willing to include these white healers in their midst, especially Stan, who was living in exile because the communists were preventing his return to his native Czechoslovakia. All at once, the angry man's face changed. He leapt to his feet, crossed the fire, and fell into Stan's lap, sobbing. For many minutes, he hugged Stan and the others nearby, apologizing for his misguided hatred. As he wept, his story poured out. He'd flown a bomber in the Air Force during World War II. In the last weeks of the war, as the Nazis withdrew, his plane had bombed and unnecessarily destroyed Pilsen, one of Czechoslovakia's most beautiful cities, even though Czechoslovakia had been anti-Nazi and forcibly occupied by Germany. Now the tables had turned. Not only did Stan and the Czechs never steal Indian land, but he, a Potawatomi Indian, had helped destroy Stan's homeland. He was the perpetrator, and Stan's people were the victims. This realization was more than he could bear. He kept embracing Stan, begging forgiveness, apologizing for his behavior during the sacred ceremony. Then he paused to say what he had learned. "I see now that there can be no hope for the world if we carry hatred for deeds committed by our ancestors. I know now you are not my enemies, but my brothers. All that happened long ago, and it was in the time of our ancestors, and who knows, at that time I might have been on the other side. We are all children of the Great Spirit. Our Mother Earth is in trouble, and if we do not work together, we will all die. Recognizing the Buddha in one another. In Buddhist mythology, it is said that each new era is served by a Buddha who offers a perfect form of teachings for that time. Maitreya, the Buddha of love, is the name given to the Buddha who will next appear on earth. However, Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh has stated that this next Buddha may not appear in the form of a single awakened individual. As our understanding of interdependence grows, he says, the next Buddha may be the Sangha itself. That means that collectively we will be the ones helping one another awaken. A cartoon in a San Francisco paper showed a man walking down the street with a signboard that proclaimed, "Jesus is coming." Half a block behind was an Asian-looking fellow wearing a signboard that read, "Buddha here now." In spiritual maturity, we realize that both Buddha and Jesus are here now in everyone we meet, including the man carrying the first sign. There is a traditional practice of meeting all beings as the Buddha, of seeing Christ in each of us. Rabbi Hillel called this simple understanding the summary of all the holy words: love God by loving your neighbor. It is expounded by Zen Master Dogen when he says, "To be enlightened is to be intimate with all things." We have now come full circle. We are back to the art of bowing, of bringing respect to life as it is. This is a beginning and an advanced practice for students and abbots, lamas, beginners and elders alike, to meet each being as our brother and sister. The foolishness of others, the frustration, blame, and conflict we encounter, the struggle and betrayal, can all be met with a bow. They come to us as Mara came to the Buddha, to awaken us to compassion yet again. "The only devils in the world," said Mahatma Gandhi, "are the ones running around in our own hearts. This is where the battle must be fought." When Ram Dass taught a series of classes on service several years ago in Oakland, participants wrestled with how it is possible to see the divine in everyone they encounter. After some weeks, one woman stood up and said she had been putting change into a homeless man's cup every day for months, but that since the class, she'd come to realize that she had never really looked at him. Reflecting on this surprised her. "I discovered my big fear was that if I looked him in the eyes, by the next week he would be sleeping on my living room couch." At first there is fear. If we open to one another fully, how can we not be overwhelmed by their suffering? It seems our hearts cannot possibly be big enough to contain it all. Or we become afraid that we will have to give everything away, including ourselves. But this is not what is asked. What is asked is our compassionate attention, the inclusion in our hearts of the joys and sorrows of our brothers and sisters. When we see the Buddha who lives within all beings, a wise and natural response will emerge. Compassionate listening. Compassionate listening is a key to transforming the world. In an act of peacemaking diplomacy, Jean Knudsen-Hoffmann and others from Quaker, Buddhist, and Jewish backgrounds have founded the Compassionate Listening Project. Committed to world peace, the project has sent teams to try to understand the most isolated and conflicted figures worldwide. They have visited Muammar Gaddafi in Libya and listened to all sides of the warring parties in Central American revolutions and given their ear to the most fanatical factions in Asia and the Middle East. Their belief is that through a deep listening to the sorrows and predicaments of others, the conflicts will change. The Tao calls this listening with the heart so that we can find the way. This listening compassion embraces our own struggles as well. We give too much away only if we forget that the circle of compassion also includes ourselves. With a wise compassion, we discover what is right for others and what is right for ourselves. We awaken our heart's amazing capacity to hold all that is human. We realize that we ourselves are part of all that lives. The compassionate heart grows strong from this truth. Several years after the Los Angeles riots or insurrections of 1993, I joined together with Maladoma Somme, Luis Rodriguez, and Michael Mead to begin a series of multicultural retreats to address the difficult dialogue on race. In one retreat, 100 men from the Black and Latino communities of Watts and East Los Angeles joined with white participants for teachings, storytelling, truth-speaking, and healing rituals. The retreat drew on communal practices from the ancient traditions of West Africa, Native America, and the Buddhist elders to attempt to create a common ground for understanding. It was a fiery and passionate week. One of the most heated moments came when a white man told how frightened he'd become for his family when the Los Angeles riots or insurrection came within 2 miles of his home. He was so frightened he had gone out and bought a gun for protection. As he said this, several African-American men instantly bolted from their seats to confront him. "Who you gonna kill with that gun? You know who you got to shoot at, black men," one man said. Another shouted, "You talk about fear. If you want to be afraid, brother, you better look in the mirror. Look who invented the machine gun, the landmine. Look at the owners of gun factories. Look at who built nuclear weapons and then used them. Look at who shipped 20 million people to this country as slaves, who fought the biggest wars in the last 1,000 years, who colonized the world. You want to be afraid, look at white people. You better sell that gun, man." Several white men rose to support the man with the gun and began shouting back about defense for individuals. Other black men argued louder. The tension was building. We wondered if we could keep the room from exploding. Finally, Ralph Steele, a 6'2" African-American Buddhist teacher, stood up. In his voice, we could hear the soft echoes of the South Carolina Gullah language of his childhood. "I live in rural New Mexico," he said, "where everyone has guns for hunting and protection, but I don't have one. When I was in Vietnam, I saw enough shooting to last a lifetime. We would go out on patrol or into the villages, and every day somebody would get shot, sometimes your best friend. We would get to a new area, and people there would move, and some of the guys would get spooked and start shooting. Later we found we shot women and children. There were even some human beings in our company who liked shooting other human beings, even women and children. We didn't know what to do with them. It was my life for 2 years. You don't want a gun. It doesn't matter who you are, you don't want a gun. You don't want the dreams, the nightmares that come from using a gun. You don't even want the memory of a gun in your hand. You gotta live a lifetime with that." Ralph finished speaking and stood quietly looking around, and all the other men sat down. He had spoken without anger or defensiveness, with a compassion bigger than all the anger and fear in the room. We were silent for a while. By listening with the heart, by giving voice to the truth of compassion, one person can turn the energy of conflict back toward peace. In every relationship and community, there will be frustration, blame, grasping, anger, and betrayal. No matter who we are, nor how enlightened, these things will come. It is here that our connection and community will help us. In emphasizing the Sangha as the Buddha, Thich Nhat Hanh reminds us that wisdom is held collectively. When we or our community are stuck and cannot find the blessings of compassion, Someone bringing us true spiritual friendship can open the gates to heaven. This is the power of the rabbi's table, the AA meeting, the Sufi gathering of truth, the Buddhist council. In our own community, we draw on the Buddhist elders' ancient tradition of seeking consensus by meeting regularly in council. To this listening council, we have added the Native American talking stick and encouraged simplicity and unrehearsed truth. Then, when difficult issues, such as resolving conflicts between teachers, choosing staff, or setting new directions for our center arise, we meet in council. Whoever holds the stick is listened to without interruption. Then it is passed to others. In this way, each person gets to speak his or her heart. Out of this respectful listening, we find healing, consensus, and new direction. Over the years, such heartfelt counsel has carried the wisdom of our collective experience more fully than any one of us could have done individually. Even at a distance, spiritual friendship can support us. Jungian analyst James Hillman gives an account of Chinese dissident Liu Qing, who served 11 years in the notorious Weinan No. 2 prison. Liu was forced to sit unmoving on an 8-inch stool for 10 hours a day, and if he moved or talked to other prisoners, he was beaten. To end his suffering, he needed only sign a statement admitting mistakes in his thinking. Against all odds, he refused to sign. When asked later how he remained strong, Liu said he saw before him the faces of friends and family and knew he could not sign. His heart's connection with this community of beings would not permit betrayal of them. The Gyari 14 is a group of young Tibetan nuns aged 14 to 21 who were imprisoned and beaten by the Chinese Communist Army for publicly reciting their chants and prayers. Yet even in prison, they resolved to remain united in their determination to pray and sing freely. When they managed to smuggle out a tape of prayers sung in the prison, their sentences were doubled, yet they remained steadfast. They wrote, "We are grateful for the support of so many outside the prison, and we will never forget." Most remarkably, they pray not for themselves, but for the people of their country and for their captors. In the documentary film made about their struggle called A Prayer for the Enemy, they speak through a smuggled letter. "We have been treated so terribly. What should we do? What can we do? We pray for the enemy." In our own countryside, in our cities, hospitals, and jails, we find so many who need our prayers, the sick and the well, the prisoners and the guards. The prayers of these young nuns are joined with ours. We offer our blessings. We share our trust in the healing beyond all sorrows. We expand the circle of the heart. The heart's intention. Becoming aware of intention is a key to awakening in moment-to-moment practice. In each situation that calls for our engagement, some inner intention will precede our response. Buddhist psychology teaches that intention is what makes the pattern of our karma. Karma, the cause and result of every action, comes from the heart's intentions that precede each action. When our intentions are kind, the karmic result is very different from when they are greedy or aggressive. If we are not aware, we will unconsciously act out of habit and fear. But if we attend to our intentions, we can notice if they spring from the body of fear or from our deliberate thoughtfulness and care. Every tradition offers prayers and meditations for setting the heart's best intention. Sometimes the intentions are general, May the words of my mouth and the dedications of my heart serve you, O Lord. Or may my every activity be a prayer. Or may my heart freely offer loving kindness and forgiveness. Or I vow to bring awakening to every being I meet in thought, word, and deed. The Jewish tradition uses hundreds of prayers throughout the day to foster a seamless gratitude and love of the heart. Intentions can also be focused on one day or one situation. May I remember my breath and center myself each time I encounter conflict today. Or may I treat all those at work with kindness. Or may I take the time this week to let my family know I love them. In times of difficulty, it is this repeated setting of our heart's compass that determines the result. Whether in a family disagreement or community conflict, before we speak and act, we can become aware of our deepest intention. Even the simplest words can have a vastly different effect depending on our intention. The phrase, "What do you mean?" can sound accusing and judgmental, or considerate and humble. Our hearts are like seismographs picking up the tremors of intent. Notice how this works in conversation. Do we speak from a subtle sense of control or self-righteousness? Or do we really wish to listen, to learn? If we set our minds toward freedom, our good intentions will help us to let go of what blocks our openness. If we set our hearts toward compassion, we will reaffirm our love in spite of whatever difficulties we face. Instead of inflaming a bad situation, we can seek ways of touching the good in one another. Without denying pain and injustice, we can also look for the secret beauty of others. Our spiritual practice can be this simple: to see with the eyes of compassion and act with our wisest intention. This often has a surprising effect. Nelson Mandela put it this way: thinking too well of people often allows them to behave better than they otherwise would. Do not doubt the transformation that can be born out of such conscious attention. When Ananda, the attendant and close friend of the Buddha, met a young outcast woman at a village well, he politely asked her for a drink of water. But she was ashamed and refused him, lest her untouchability contaminate his holiness. Ananda replied, "I ask not for caste, but for water." Her life was transformed by this simple kindness, and she joyously and lovingly followed Ananda to the monastery. There the Buddha blessed her and bid her take up the kindness that Ananda had shown her, and by keeping that simple intention to let the actions of her life shine like the jewels of royalty. It is in such small things that we fulfill the lessons of the heart. It is from our intentions that our life grows. It is in opening to one another that our path is made whole. Community is serving the beloved. Mother Teresa spoke of seeing Christ in the poor and sick. The poet Rumi longs for the divine. In the face of everything separate, I want to see only you. And when he remembers there is nothing but God, he laughs and says, "Why struggle to open a door between us when the whole wall is an illusion?" With every in and out breath, with every mouthful of food, with every word we voice, we express our interbeing with all that lives. Modern technology makes this visible in new ways, from the internet to CNN. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir quipped, "Television has made dictatorship impossible and democracy intolerable. We are all in it together." One Western Lama recalls, "After I had trained in India with my guru, a highly revered Rinpoche, I developed such respect for the lineage, the group of masters he represented. These men had carried the pinnacle of Buddhist realization for centuries until he brought it out of Tibet. On one of my last days with him, I was walking the 3 miles out to his cottage, practicing the taking and sending of compassion. All at once, my understanding of the lineage grew. It wasn't just the high lamas, but it was the devoted tea ladies who fed the pilgrims on the way to the lama from their roadside stands. It was the old herders and the Tibetan traders who visited and supported him. It was the clothes washer pounding clothes down by the river, the cook in his kitchen, the herbs that grew in his garden. The world was serving my lama, and he was serving them. We exist in a mandala of wholeness amidst a sea of Buddhas, visible whenever we open the eyes of love and wisdom. When my friend and colleague Gil Fronsdal traveled to Morocco as a young man, he went far out into the Sahara Desert. There he and a companion were taken in by a Bedouin tribe, as was the custom of these nomadic Arabs. For 3 days they were given lavish feasts and so much care and attention that Gil said, "I felt like we were kings." When the time came to leave, they offered many thanks. Gil went on, "After I returned home, I realized I had understood it wrong. It was they who were the royalty, they who showed us the true generosity of kings." To serve the Buddha is to admire the one before us, to see them as Buddha, to welcome them as Christ. One of my teachers, Ajahn Jumnian, talks about this in his role as abbot. He looks to admire the Buddha in everyone who comes to the temple. Most Thai men are ordained for some period of their life, and he receives each postulant with admiration. When a local boxing champ came to be ordained, Ajahn Jumnian asked if he would like to be his bodyguard. "I had no need for a bodyguard, but he guarded me with so much dignity, eventually he became a fine monk." Another man arrived boasting in an egotistical way about his prowess as a builder. Ajahn Jumnian smiled and said, "Excellent. We've needed a new meditation hall for some time now. I turn the whole project over to you." Our nobility blossoms when we are admired and respected. Years ago, Ram Dass went to his guru, Neem Karoli Baba, to ask, "How can I best be enlightened?" His guru answered, "Love people." When he asked about the most direct path to awakening, his guru answered, "Feed people. Love people and feed people. Serve the divine in every form." Kabir, the Indian mystic, says, "There is only one thing that will satisfy my heart, to serve you with every breath." Service is the expression of the awakened heart. But who are we serving? It is ourselves. When someone asked Gandhi how he could so continually sacrifice himself for India, he replied, "I do this for myself alone." When we serve others, we serve ourselves. The Upanishads call this God feeding God. A wise spiritual community must serve something larger than itself. If people gather in community primarily to alleviate their own isolation and loneliness, to have their needs fulfilled by others, they become like a group of needy children, and the community inevitably fails. But if their vision and creativity is in service to the sacred, to God, to the larger common good, there is a better chance for a healthy and wise community to grow. Past generations in America understood this in ways that we've largely forgotten. Our history is filled with examples of communal care for one another, from barn raising to the sharing of food and seeds in times of hunger, to church going and spiritual partnership. In times of disaster, like the Great Plains flood a few years ago, there is a remarkable outpouring of mutual aid across every barrier of class and race. After life is normal again, people speak wistfully of wanting to keep the spirit that made everyone neighbors. We hold those pioneer and immigrant communities like a genetic memory, reminding us of what we can be to one another. Serving one another is an expression of our sacred connection. It reawakens the oneness that has been lost, allows us to look again into the eyes of another and see the divine that shines in all things. One senior Buddhist practitioner who regularly does hospice work remembers that she had a stronger connection to her dying patients than to almost anyone else in her life. "At first I thought it was because of their openness in the face of death," she said. "But then I realized it was mostly because I do several periods of loving-kindness meditation for them daily." When you intentionally offer your loving wishes, your prayers, and blessings for someone over and over, it changes your own heart. You become the love you offer. We are each engaged in a multitude of acts of service to our brothers and sisters. Every time we stop at a red light, offer money to a cashier, say hello, wash the dishes, put out the trash cans, we serve our family, our community, and the earth. In each of our daily roles, as builder or merchant, gardener or artist, teacher, healer, secretary or salesman, in each of these roles we can awaken compassion. We can find the spirit of Sangha and freedom. The scope of service, says the Indian master Meher Baba, is not limited to heroic acts, great gestures, and huge donations to public institutions. They also serve who express their love in little things, a word that gives courage to a broken heart, or a smile that brings hope in the midst of gloom, is as much service as heroic sacrifice. A glance that wipes out bitterness from the heart is also service, although there may be no thought of service in it. When taken by themselves, all these things seem to be small. But life is made up of many small things, and if these small things were ignored, life would not only be unbeautiful, it would be unbearable.
This concludes tape 5 of After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, with Jack Kornfield. Our program continues with tape 6.